Welcome to the Empowerment Zone with Ramona Houston, where we zone in on Black and Brown relations and our journey to empowering our communities.
Thank you for joining the Empowerment Zone. I am your host, Ramona Houston. Today, our guest is Shalia Fox, who oversees development and external relations at Black Studies at the University of Texas at Austin. And as many of you know, that is my alma mater, so I am so delighted to have Shalia here with us. She helps the Black Studies Department, which is a collective that includes a policy institute, an academic department, and a cultural and programming division. There she assists with getting Black alumni involved in the university. And so today we're going to talk a lot about philanthropy and how we can change the conversation in terms of African-Americans and Latinos involved in philanthropy. Hi, Shalia. How are you this morning?
I'm doing fantastic. How are you, Ramona?
I'm doing fine. So tell our audience a little bit about yourself and how you got into philanthropy, and then we'll move the conversation toward looking at how Black and Brown people can be more involved in philanthropy and changing or influencing the development of that sector.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, most people who are in fundraising didn't go to school for fundraising. I think now the landscape is changing for the industry, and there are some certifications and programs that you can do. But when I was in grad school and even in undergrad, philanthropy or fundraising wasn't necessarily a field of study. So really, most people who are involved in it, they've either known somebody in fundraising or they stumbled upon it, maybe had an entry-level position, saw somebody who's doing the work and said, oh, that's exciting, I want to get into it. So all this to say is this was not ever my professional aspirations. So I have two masters. I have degrees in social work and public administration and policy. And I think why that's what, and I wanted to focus on nonprofit management. And why it's important for me to mention that is that if you want to be a leader in the nonprofit sector, you have to have a high level of comfort with asking people for money, right? And building relationships and stewarding folks and kind of inviting them in to be a part of the work that you're hoping to do and the impact you're hoping to make with communities across the country. So it definitely is important to know fundraising if you're in that field. But again, that was not ever my focus. And so my entree into fundraising really began in the private sector doing business development. And then during that time, I wasn't necessarily fulfilled with that career, right? Because I went to school for social work, was really hoping to impact the nonprofit world. And so I dug my toes in and got involved in my community and started a nonprofit that works with foster care youth. And in that role was really when I learned how to fundraise, really when I learned how to perfect an elevator pitch, but not in the sense that you're doing sales. I'd done sales with business development, but really it's about, and I said this earlier, it's about inviting people in and connecting passions that people have to opportunities to make impact. And so I was able to take both of those skill sets, that business development, private sector, and then my experience with fundraising for a passion project of mine, and relay it that to the work of fundraising in higher education, which is where I am today working for Black Studies. As you mentioned, an incredible collective at your alma mater, and I hope it makes you incredibly proud to hear the work that's happening there. And so in this current role, or in my role, to your point, my work is, it's my mandate, let me be clear, my mandate is not to just work with Black and Brown alumni. But what I do know is that Black and Brown people want to see Black and Brown people leading initiatives. And that's when we talk about the field of philanthropy. A lot of the times the foundations that are giving the money are giving money to advanced causes, but those causes aren't necessarily led by the communities that have the same lived experiences. So they're not Black and Brown led initiatives for the most part. And we're seeing a little bit of a shift. You know, there's definitely leaders and foundations that are doing the work, but we got a lot more work to do. So naturally, my conversations are mostly with Black and Brown alumni at the university because of that. It's definitely the work we're doing, but it's also the appeal that the work we're doing is led by people that have the same shared experience. And so that's, and I wanted to situate that. That's why a lot of the people that I end up talking to end up being Black and Brown alumni. I mean, obviously I love them, right? They're my people, right? So I love talking to my people, but I think that's the power of the collective. One, the work is good. Two, it's 100% led by the people that know these communities and know that the impact, where the impact of the work needs to go and what it needs to look like.
So what is your mandate at the University of Texas?
So my mandate is to fundraise. It's to first of all, build relationships with alumni, help tap into what their philanthropic passions are and how we can connect them back to the university to do that work. So primarily I work with alumni, but as you mentioned in the introduction, the collective is more than just an academic department, which is where alumni come from, right? They come from departments, they get their degrees, and that usually is where their loyalty and their allegiance to is the Department of English, the Department of History in your case, right? But the academic department or the wing of Black Studies is only 10 years old. So we just don't have that natural alumni base. But because we have a cultural programming division, because we have a policy institute and two art galleries, our supporter base can, you know, can far extend the campus, right? We can be talking to people who want to see Black representation in art spaces, to people who understand the power of having policy action behind the research. And so it extends beyond alumni. It extends to people who just want to see the value of Black life and Black intellectual production supported. But my mandate is to fundraise, build relationships with alumni, and really tell the story of Black studies across the world, really.
So, I want to talk a little bit about, you know, the University of Texas and this whole new initiative with Black Studies, because mm-hmm. when I came there, it was just the Center for Black Studies. But now, mm-hmm. like you said, it's a consortium of a lot of different divisions. And it appears to be a big attempt to get people of color involved in the University of Texas in terms of alumni engagement. Could you talk a little bit about why there's such an effort now and why this is important work in terms of getting alumni involved in these predominantly white institutions? And it, because I wanted to, even though we're using University of Texas as an example,
right.
It's a wider effort that we need to consider in terms of getting people of color involved in alumni engagement.
Yeah, I think something that I want to reiterate what you just said is that the Black and Brown experience at PWIs is not unique to UT, right? And so to your point that the work, I don't want to say it's formulaic, but I think that this is an experience that is felt across the country. And I know now, especially in the time that we're in, considering the agitation that's taking place around the racial injustice across our country, you know, our current administration's lack, you know, just not really understanding, not having their finger on the pulse of the Black and Brown communities in the country. I think that there has been this renewed commitment to engaging with alumni of color. So it's definitely that time. And then back when Black Studies, and then also the Division of Diversity and Community Engagement, which is at the university as well. At the time that they were formulated, we had really strong leadership that was committed to making sure that the Longhorn legacy included alumni of color included celebrating the faculty research and the faculty accomplishments and honoring student activism, which led to the creation of ethnic studies on the campus over 50 years ago. I mean, UT is a lot of things, and being in Texas means a lot of things, but the fact that UT was one of the first universities in the South or the West, depending on who you're talking to really adopt the ethnic studies center model back in the 60s is a big deal. And so I say that, and it wasn't necessarily because leadership said, why don't we do this? It's because students and faculty advocated, they activated for it, they demanded it. And so that history of activism is very much rooted in the department. So I do think that there is something there and something special about UT. And then the times over the last decade that we've had really strong leadership has led to the creation of both of these institutes. And then now when you add the layer of the call for Juneteenth to be a national holiday and the fact that that history really is rooted in Texas, when you think about just last week or maybe this week, interim president Jay Hartzell sent a long email to the campus and to the supporters about their efforts to diversify the campus and to really become a welcoming space for Black students, Black and Brown students, but this is really specifically focusing on Black students. They want to honor the precursors, which is the incoming undergraduate class at UT starting in 56. I think that there is a sea change and there is a momentum because it originates with the students. The students have stood up and said, this is enough. This is what we demand because we know UT can be better. And I think when the students do this, when that youth, that sense of ownership over history, when they stand up and they demand and really invite you to come alongside them and be on the right side of history, it takes a certain type of leader to ignore that, right? And we are lucky that we don't have that sort of leadership right now. And so, I think that I definitely want to give credit to our current leadership and taking some really big steps today and then previous leadership that led to the formation of the collective and then also DDCE. But we would be remiss if we didn't talk about the might of student activism on campus. And so I think that that's what sets PWIs that are actually doing the action or doing the work apart, is that there is a student agitation that is formidable, that they are organizing in a way that they can't ignore.
You know, you're saying something that's very important is student activism. As mm-hmm. Frederick Douglass said, power concedes nothing without demand. It never has and never will. So the student activism is initiating these changes on these majority campuses. But why do you feel, as a person who's involved in alumni engagement, why is it important that alumni of color be involved? Like, a lot of alumni, once they leave, because they had such a bad experience, they're not involved in the institution. So why do you feel like it's important for them to come and make an investment, whether it be financially, whether it be their time, whether it be their influence? You know, you're working to get them involved, right? But make the argument of why they should be involved.
I think that, there's a couple. The main reason is that most people who go through traumatic experiences wouldn't wish that upon anybody else. I mean, there are times, I'm making a general statement, but most of the people that I talk to that have experienced trauma or any sort of difficult situation, they don't want someone else to go through that. And I think when you look at students on campuses today and you look at what they're going through, I think there's a real responsibility and there's a real opportunity for alumni to come alongside students and support them to make sure that the environment that was present when they were on campus does not exist, or fight to make sure it cannot exist today. And so that their college experience is markedly different than the one that they had 10 years ago, 15 years ago, 60 years ago. So I think that, you know, whenever there's this saying that if you're still complaining about something that has, I can't remember, but basically if you are complaining about or lamenting about your time in a place and you're not doing anything to change it, then you just gotta, you gotta close it, close them lips, you know? And I think that this is a real way to give your talent and your time, because UT alum are special. I mean, I know every, but I think that going through what a lot of Black and Brown alum went through on campus, it speaks to their specialness. And I think that they have an opportunity to bestow that special, to use what is very special about them to make sure that students feel supported as they are really putting themselves on the line. I mean, that's the other thing. Alumni really don't have anything to lose by standing up and supporting students. They're off campus. They have their degree. They've got, you know, their they've gotten what they've came from. And so it's a pretty low, it's low stakes for them to just share a demand letter, to interact with alumni groups on Facebook and, you know, like something and leave a comment of support. But it means a lot to the students. And so I think that is one piece. The other piece is that your degree is only as, there's a couple of things that make your degree valuable, but, and as we look at rankings, alumni engagement is one of the indicators of national standing for universities. And so the more alumni engage, the better that university stands to be rated. And I think that that also is an incentive so that your degree remains valuable, is to keep that engagement level high, and then also support the students that are leaving so that they can go out and be successful, and then in turn make sure that your degree remains something that is valuable within within the world's understanding of academia. So I think those are two reasons. And the third one is giving to your alma mater and giving to an institution that is supporting students' activism is an incredible way to fulfill your own philanthropic passion if you are socially justice minded. And the person is political. Our bodies are political. Our existence is political. We don't have the luxury of not being socially justice minded, right? And so, you know, this is, to me, is a natural way to give your time, your treasure, and talent at this point in time in support of students. I can't think of something that wouldn't be, it's incredibly meaningful.
I'm glad you talked about that, because a lot of people, when we leave, if we had traumatic experiences, we leave and then we don't come back. Mm-hmm. And you gave some really clear arguments of why we should be involved. I, as you know, I'm a member of the visiting committee of the Department of History. Mm-hmm. And
thank you very much.
Yeah. And I remember one of my meetings, one young lady, you know, was coming and talking to me and saying, you know, she was so happy that I was on the committee. And, you know, she asked me when I graduated, and I told her I graduated in 2000. Well, what she didn't know was that the first graduate, Black graduate of the University of Texas, the late Dr. Alton Hornsby, graduated in 1968. And that I was the second Black graduate in 2000, which I'm just putting that in context right, to say that there were a lot of hoops that I had to jump mm-hmm. to get that. It was a very challenging experience navigating through that process. But she has me, oh, wow, you know, I met my husband here. We love the institution. How was your experience? And I told her I hated it. And she was like floored. She's like, oh my God, so why are you here? I said, I want to make sure that other students of color don't have the same experience I had, right. You know? And so, you know, I say all that to say that it is important. You know, we just got our first African-American chair of the department, right?
And an incredible chair. And you know, she's been on campus for, I think, almost two decades. I think she came in 2011. So, you know, but she was amazing when she came, you know, that it wasn't like all of a sudden we've got a star among us. We always had a star among us, right? And I'm celebrating that she is there. I don't want to take away from that joy, but also about time.
Yes, and I'm actually delighted that she's there. Well, let's say her name, Dr. Dana Ramey Berry. And so we're so delighted to have her as chair, and we can just imagine the challenges she has,
right.
She had, and right. will have, being in that, being the chair of that department. But we wish her the best.
Absolutely.
And like you say, alumni have to be involved. And so I'm glad you made that argument mm-hmm. about mm-hmm. the importance of us being involved, those of us who graduated from majority campuses and have not been engaged, that
right.
we need to re-engage. So for the last few minutes, I want to pivot a little to look at the world of philanthropy mm-hmm. and talk about why people of color, particularly African Americans and Latino Americans, should be involved in the world of philanthropy and how we'll change the landscape through our presence. Not just about diversity,
right.
but talking about how we can change the structural, systemic issues of philanthropy mm-hmm. and the problems that we have there in terms of, you sent me this great article, which I can't wait to read the book that you referred, but how we can really change the way philanthropy operates.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. You know, and it's so interesting. I was just having, the Black Studies Department Chair, Dr. Sheree Smith, who's also the first Black woman to hold this position for Black Studies. We've been talking a lot about philanthropy for years, and her just really situating the act of giving as it relates to her family. You know, it's not that, you know, well, first of all, the way that we measure capacity, we use indicators of giving across multiple fields. And communities of color are giving, but they're not necessarily giving in ways that are showing up in databases and mm-hmm. lists that you can just search and pull from online. And so an example that she was sharing is that, you know, a lot of the way that they give is familial support. When there's somebody yes. that needs something, that's what you do. You've got the means. It's just cultural. It's just what you do. And that's philanthropy, right? Yes. And that's how we don't necessarily have a name for it. It's called survival. It's called investing in the people that you love. Mm-hmm. But I think that even in itself is a privilege that non-communities of color have been able to identify a term for giving outside of the family because they had the capacity to give outside of the family. And then when they're giving outside of the family, they're giving to communities that are underserved, which historically are Black and Brown communities. So even when we're talking about the language, even when we're talking about the genesis of philanthropy, who became philanthropists were the barons. They were the railroad tycoons. There were oil and gas. I mean, this is how philanthropy began. And it began because they wanted to get tax breaks and wanted to, you know. So again, it's not ever been motivated truly by altruism. I mean, there's always a second gain. But when you look at community of color's philanthropy, it's 100% altruism. It's 100% designed to give, to support. And, you know, you'd like to add some strings, but sometimes you give that money just knowing you ain't never going to see it.
Yeah.
And you're never going to see the impact. And you're never going to get a report. And you're, you know, like that. So, you know, the things that the guiding stars, the North Stars of philanthropic giving are rooted in this idea that there's something that you get in return, right? And the true value of philanthropy, the value that we know as community of color is the North Star is just giving to make sure that people can live, right? And so already we're talking about two different experiences, but this is the experience, the philanthropy, the mainstream philanthropy that we have all come to know, all come to understand, all come to celebrate, revere as being how we want to interact with philanthropy in our society. And so I think that's the first thing, important thing to call out, is that from the very beginning, it was designed to subjugate and also lock us out of the conversation. So that's the first thing.
No, go ahead. You know, I want to expand on that, because I think we need to figure out a term for our type of giving. Yes. You know, when you look at the Latino community specifically, you know, many people are sending money back home to their home countries, right? Many are supporting the quinceañeras, right?
Right.
And funding those.
Yes.
We do our funerals. Hey, when there's a funeral, like this recent tragedy, George Floyd, there were Black folks, wealthy Black folks said, y'all don't have to worry about this funeral because, you know, funerals cost a lot of money. We got you.
We got you. Yes.
And so, with nothing, not an expectation in return, but just the point that we want to give because we want to make your life better. And even those who invested in historically Black colleges and universities, it wasn't for them. It was for the next generation. And, you know, this whole transactional piece of philanthropy is, if I give, I'm going to help my image, and I'm going to get a tax write-off. That's right. A different kind. It's some. We need to use the term. We need to develop a term to distinguish.
It needs to be, what if we approach philanthropy from the same lens that community of colors approach giving? And I'm not going to call it, because you're right, we need to change it. Like, what would it look like for foundations to change their application process? What would it look like for them to change the reporting requirements? Because here's the deal, the way they have it set up, it's designed for the same foundation, the same organizations to apply and get the funding year after year after year. And these are the same organizations that have been racist. They've locked Scout Committee. I mean, their leadership, you look at the boards, they're all white, all male. The leadership team that are actually running the programs are all white, mostly female, but still, you get it's, they're the most egregious offenders of lack of diversity and lack of inclusivity in these leadership positions that we know are contributing to the fact that our voice is not being represented. So, but what would it look like for philanthropy and foundations to completely flip their script of what they've decided on what is deserving? And so, and that whenever I am applying for grants for Black Studies and specifically for the Policy Institute, I lead with the fact that this is an unapologetically Black-led initiative. These are Black professors. These are Black students, and they're not to say it's all Black, but there's something that we cannot quantify or qualify about the importance of the people that have those shared experiences that are leading the work. It just, you get more community buy-in. You bring that experience and that understanding to the table. And that's what we know is so valuable when we are able to participate in leadership positions or have a seat at the table. It's more than just our presence. It's what we're bringing, the fresh perspective that we're bringing. And so, I'm with you. There's got to be a new term, and we've got to say, we're done trying to act like you. Y'all need to act like us.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And change the whole paradigm of how we operate. And the other piece is the fact that these large foundations only give like 5% of their money.
Thank you.
So it's like this whole point of the whole point of maintaining wealth in the hands of a few. So we just need to, you know, reimagine philanthropy and how it operates. And I'm so glad you're able to add some understanding in our conversation about philanthropy and educate our audience on reimagining philanthropy. Mm-hmm. So Shalia, I'm so happy that you joined me today. I want you to come back to expand more.
Absolutely, I would love to.
I would love to have you again. And so thank you so much for joining us. And I look forward to having you again soon.
Absolutely. This was a delight. And I feel like I could talk to you forever. So thank you, Ramona.
Thank you.
All right. Bye.
Hello, welcome. We have Ms. Shalia Fox today, and she's a graduate of Florida State University. She received her BS in psychology, and she has two master's degrees from Florida State, one in social work and the other one in public administration and policy. So I'm delighted to have her today because she's going to give us this great advice that will help students in terms of developing strategies for student success. So what is your one piece of advice for college students?
So the one thing that I know made a big difference in my, both my educational and my professional career is that I had a professional mentor. And I think that it's important to differentiate this. It is somebody that you don't necessarily want to be friends with, although that would make things easier, but it's somebody who you can mimic your entire professional self around, that you look at their emails, you look how they carry themselves in meetings, you look how they build relationships in the office, and even look at their career trajectory, and you really just copy and paste. And, you know, and I'm saying this in the beginning, it's really important because you don't really know what it is that you want to do. And at that time, it's really okay for you to kind of copy and paste. And then as you get older, as you become more confident in who you are as a professional person, you can, you know, make adjustments and add your own little personal touches. But I think I can think back to who my professional mentor was. And even when I talked to her about going to grad school, she's the one who encouraged me to get two masters instead of one. She goes, because quite simply, you're going to change where you want to go in your life. And having that second degree will help make you more marketable. It will help you develop a vocabulary that will make you stronger. And, you know, and not to say anything against a social work degree. I love it. I'm very proud of the fact that I'm a social worker, but it definitely flexes one muscle. And just to be able to have a complementary degree to flex another muscle, it really makes you more more marketable. You know, I'm sure there's another word I can use, but, and I would not have even have thought that if I didn't already have this person who I looked up to tremendously and how they went about it, obtaining their career. And I trusted her. I knew that what she was saying was true because she was a truthful person, but because everything else that I had mirrored after her had led to my success, you know, at that point. So definitely find yourself a professional mentor.
Great advice. All of us need mentors. Mm-hmm. Yes. When we begin in undergraduate school, we need mentors throughout graduate school.
Absolutely.
We need mentors as professionals.
Mm-hmm.
So get yourself a mentor. Thank
yes.
you, Shalia.
Oh, you're welcome. Thanks for having me.
A special thank you to the incredible team of the Empowerment Zone. Terry Ungully, theme song. NADWORKS, digital support. And of course, our featured guest.
If you enjoyed my podcast, please subscribe. We are on all of your favorite podcast platforms. Be sure to rate us on Apple Podcasts too. Thank you for your continued support.